Accession number 17572, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Paul Millett, recorded by Rodney Giesler in Andover on the 21st of May 1997 for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive.
Right, okay, we're live. You're born in Swindon?
Right, in 1931.
1931. And did you come from a sort of aviation family or naval family or anything?
Well, not directly. In fact, my grandfather was in the Navy, but that wasn't any reason for me joining the Royal Navy. And I had a cousin in the Air Force during World War II. But obviously everybody and every schoolboy is fascinated by aeroplanes anyway.
So what made you decide on the Navy then, is that way in, rather than the RAF?
The RAF's fault. Whilst I was still at school, one of the chaps who I knew very well, a little older than me, joined the RAF as a Halton apprentice and was then selected to become aircrew, and I thought, what a lovely thing to do. So I applied and went up and did all the interviews at North Weald, and end of which they said, right, you're in, sign here. And I said, well, hold on a minute, I don't really want to join instantly because I want to go back to school and take the school certificate. And they sucked their teeth a little and said, well, oh, very well. And so I went back and did school certificate and then returned for really just the formality of signing on. They said, we better give you another medical, see if anything's happened to you in the meantime. And then told me, sorry, but you failed. And typical of the service mentality, they wouldn't say why, but again, possibly intentionally, I found myself in a room at one time with the papers in front of me. So I had a quick look to see why I'd been turned down, and this said that I had a cervical rib, which meant nothing at all to me. And I went back to my GP and said, what does all this mean? And he said, well, it's nothing really. There's an extra rib which can grow at the top of the rib cage, but it's a simple operation. If it gives any problems, to remove it. So didn't understand that. Anyway, I was turned down by the RAF, and subsequently came the time when, like all of us at that time, I was going to have to do national service. And I thought I'd rather do something interesting than march up and down on parade grounds for my 2 years national service. And at that time they were advertising for short service careers in the Fleet Air Arm, or short service commission in the Fleet Air Arm. So hence I joined Fleet Air Arm. And an interesting view on the attitude of the way in which the Fleet Air Arm was much more relaxed than the RAF, because when I told them that I had this cervical rib, they said, oh really? How interesting. We'll have a look at that. And they did a big x-ray instead of a little one. And there were even several doctors gathered around saying, look at this, isn't that interesting? But they felt it was no reason to turn me down also.
And so that involved you going where? Did you go to Dartmouth for a short while? Or what was the...
No, the training carrier at that time was HMS Victorious.
The carrier,
yes. Following its wartime career, it was downgraded as a training ship before they did the big refurbishment of it. And we actually joined at Rosyth. It's in the dockyard doing a small refit then, and cruised from there down to Portland and spent the rest of my 6 month cadet time at Portland Harbour learning how to be a seaman at that time. How to salute the right places and
so you learned how the cable deck worked and all that sort of
all the good naval things and sailing boats and driving motorboats around. It was all great fun actually.
And then where did you go from there?
Actually, we then had 3 months pre-flight training, it was called at the time, which all seemed a bit unnecessary, but this was at Donny Bristol on the Firth of Forth, where we spent 3 months doing sort of basic meteorology and learning a bit about aeroplanes, not very much, and not much naval training either. But we had to do things like learn RT procedure, which seemed all very artificial when you weren't actually flying an aeroplane. Anyway, that didn't last very long, 3 months, and then went to RAF Syreston, where we did our flying training on, initially on the Percival Prentice, which was not the greatest, most exciting aeroplane in the world, and then the Harvard, which was much more fun. That was a bit of a handful for a trainee pilot.
They're still using them then. It was what, about 1949, was it? 50?
That was 1950, 50, yes.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, yes. In fact, we were only the second course not to train on the Tiger Moth. The Prentice had just come in then.
So the Harvard was the advanced trainer, presumably, in those days.
Yep.
And from there you went to a real naval squadron? Or
that's
what?
Right. In fact, towards the end of the time on flying training and on Harvard's, we were selected for our future jobs, and two of us were selected to join the first naval jet squadron on attackers. And that was obviously going to be very exciting indeed. Now, what happened then was we went down to do decompression tests prior to starting the training, the advanced training, and I failed. I got bends. And I mean, they did crazy decompression tests. They used to take you up to 37,000 feet in a chamber and leave you there for several hours. And we did that on three successive occasions. On the third occasion, I got bends. And they said, at that time, well, you'll never fly jet airplanes. And my documents were annotated, never to fly in high-altitude aircraft. And so, a bit of a disappointment, obviously, at the time, but I went off to Lossiemouth, where the advanced training took place, and that was done either on sea fires for the fighter pilots or fireflies for the... At that time, it was strike and anti-submarine. And I did the firefly training there. 3 months at Lossiemouth, 3 months at Eglinton, learning to be anti-submarine pilots. The anti-submarine side was not overexciting. It involved a lot of dropping sonar buoys and flying around with the observer in the back listening to the noise from the sonar buoys. We did some ground attack work, firing rockets and dropping bombs on simulated submarines, which was more interesting than sonar buoy work. And at the end of that time, I joined a squadron, which was 81 Squadron on Firefly Mark 6s at Arbroath. And we did our anti-submarine workup, but in the middle of that, it was decided that we would stop being an anti-submarine squadron, be a strike squadron, and go to Korea. And so we threw away all of our sonar buoys. We got rid of the Mark 6 fireflies and went back to a mixture of 4s and 5s, which didn't have anti-submarine gubbins on, and did a workup for strike, ground attack, which was much more interesting, I must say. And from there, we went out to Malta and continued our workup, started doing a bit of carrier flying. But I left the squadron temporarily because we were due to be flying from HMS Glory. Ocean was out in Korea at the time, and they were getting a bit short of pilots. They didn't want to bring pilots out for just the last couple of months of their time out there, so they asked for 4 pilots to fly out to the Far East and join them, and I was one of the 4, We had a fascinating flight out to the Far East by BOAC and Argonauts, which took 4 days.
Can I just go back a little bit? When exactly did you do your deck landing training? Was that up at Arbroath?
The first deck landing training was during the advanced flying school work at Eglinton, so that we actually did it off Belfast in HMS Illustrious.
Can you remember your first deck landings? Were they horrendous or fairly easy?
Quite interesting. What happened was, at that time, the Navy had got sea balliols, and they wondered whether it was worth doing dual deck landings prior to sending people solo. And so I was one of the pilots who actually sat in a sea balliol, sat on the right-hand side, which is significant, and watched while another pilot, an experienced pilot, did some deck landings. I had only two deck landings. Now, to do deck landings under the old system, you did quite a tight left-handed curve onto the flight deck, following what the batsman was telling you to do, of course. So I was sitting on the right-hand side. I couldn't see very much. In an aircraft I'd never been in before, all very het up about all this deck landing business, and I learned nothing whatsoever from those two deck landings in the balliol. But we then got into our fireflies and started doing the real deck landings. It was frightening is the wrong word, but you certainly were very worried about what it was going to be like. And it's a very steep learning curve. Your first two or three deck landings, you have no idea what's going on at all, but you hope you're following the signals, and next thing you know, you've arrived on the deck, and there's lots of crashing and banging and clanging, and you've come to a stop. But it's amazing how quickly you do find out it isn't so bad after all.
Presumably you've practiced them ashore on a special runway.
Yes, you do a lot of ADLs, airfield dummy deck landings, with a batsman, and they're all carefully debriefed as well, so that you have a pretty good idea as to what you're supposed to be doing, for sure. But it's quite different when you first get to a deck. As I say, you're very tense initially, but when you can start to relax and enjoy it, it wasn't that bad.
And of course, you know, on the old propeller-driven aeroplanes, you had a pretty instantaneous throttle response. You know, if you had to go around again, you could whack the throttle open and get an instant response and leave the trouble behind you, presumably, could you?
Yes. I can't think of many occasions when if you had to go around again quite early on if you were going to do it, because you obviously couldn't get to the deck and go in again because there was a big barrier in front of you.
I was going to say, if you missed a wire, you went into the barrier.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. And no angled deck in those days.
No angled deck, no. In fact, there was a big deck park in front of you, in front of the barriers.
Expensive machinery.
Mm. And our initial deck landings actually came to a sudden halt when one of the trainee pilots bounced over both barriers, arrived in the deck park, and wrote nearly all the aircraft off at once. Yeah. Which doesn't fill you with confidence.
It's very illustrious.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. Anyhow, you flew out to the Far East and joined Ocean.
Right.
That would be when? About 52?
That was 52, yes. Sort of August, September 52.
And was that after the Incheon landings?
Yes, it was. Yes,
so the back in the north again.
It was a fairly stable front line, roughly along the 38th parallel then. So there wasn't all the time I was out there, there wasn't much movement of troops. Our job was mostly interdiction, knocking down bridges, blocking railway tunnels.
Satisfactorily?
Very, yes. Although the Korean stroke Chinese were extremely good at repairing. I mean, you could knock a bridge down and they'd put the following day, they didn't replace the bridge. They used to put trying to think of the word. No, they actually build a ridge under the in the river that trucks could run along.
Sort of ford.
So it would be quite a shallow river, and we used to knock down those one after the other as well. But an immense amount of transport would go up and down North Korea, always at night. And we spent quite a bit of time searching for them in the daytime, and they parked them in all kinds of unusual places because the camouflage was extremely good. So we used to fly around right on the deck looking for transport, and occasionally finding it. Much easier when the winter came, because you could still see the tracks.
I mean, did you have top cover? Did you meet any MiGs in that time or not?
I saw a MiG once. It just made a vague pass at us and disappeared again. We had some of the Sea Furies got much closer to MiGs than we did. And of course, when I first joined Ocean, there was a very well-known chap called Hoagy Carmichael on board, who had the great privilege of having shot down a MiG in his Sea Fury. But it's an interesting story, because the rest of his flight, who were with him at the time, all reckoned that they all shot at this thing which overshot them, and trying to slow down with air brakes out, flew across the front of all four aircraft. so they each had to go at it. So it wasn't exactly an exciting dogfight. Somebody making a mistake.
Yeah. And your armament, I mean, it was basically bombs, was it, and cannon as well?
To go that way out, isn't it?
That's better.
We could carry four 1,000-pound bombs. Two 1,000-pound bombs. And we had four 20-mil cannon. Or we could carry various loads of rockets and bombs. The Sea Furies could only carry two 500-pound bombs, so we had a lot more weight of ammunition than the Sea Fury did. And the normal routine was we would fly off with a preset target. We'd attack that target with either bombs or rockets, depending on what the target was, and then spend the rest of the time looking for opportunity targets, which we could attack with 20mm cannons.
Those are what, convoys of trucks or things like that?
Those were mainly the trucks, yes. You did occasionally see some troops, but not very often. As I say, their camouflage was superb. Flying along the front line, which we did occasionally, was an interesting experience, because on the north side of the front line, you'd see nothing. Nothing moving, no sign of anything being dug in at all. The south side, there'd be convoys going around. You could see all the works where the things had been dug in, the trenches and the whole lot. And it was quite a contrast. We used to go down the front line when we were asked to go to attack specific targets, which would be marked usually by Harvard's firing little rockets, and they were quite good actually.
And the carrier, I mean, was that far offshore?
It was. Well, it was out of range of the guns, the shore guns, of course. It was never very far offshore. We used to spend about 10 minutes, I suppose, flying to the shore, and then the rest of the time you'd be cruising up and down, finding targets.
And how long was the average sortie?
The average sortie was 2 hours. In fact, it tended to get a bit longer. Particularly, we found that because all the traffic was moving at night, we started flying, not actually flying through the night, because none of us were actually qualified in night deck landing at the time, but we'd go off 2 hours or more before dawn, and that got steadily earlier and earlier as they got more wise to what we were doing. And you could see a convoy in the distance because they'd all have their headlights on, but they had a very good system of sentries. I don't know quite how they did it, but as you got closer the lights would all go off, and so you'd have to try and give a mental picture as to where you'd seen that particular convoy. And we had quite a lot of success at that time with actually attacking trucks on the road. But we had an extra worry, because if anything had gone wrong with the aircraft, we were going to have to go back to the carrier at night. We'd never done any of that. So we were always quite pleased to see the dawn come up.
Presumably there were night qualified crews on board, were there? Or were you all daylight people?
I think we were actually all daylight. I don't recall any of us being qualified at that time.
Now, in those days, to take off, you got as far astern as you could, revved up your engines and turned into wind, and there were no catapult launches, were there?
Oh, yes. We used catapult launches wherever possible. In fact, we reached the stage where both catapults had broken down, and so we were having to do deck launches, although that wasn't entirely satisfactory, because of the weight we were carrying, we had to use rocket-assisted takeoff, RATOG gear. So you'd strap a couple of big rockets on the side and fire those as you got halfway down the deck, which would push you into the air, and then jettison the gear and fly on. But they didn't work terribly well with the Sea Furies, because they were quite sensitive to going a little too steeply off the deck, and a number of Sea Furies actually got a bit too steep on takeoff and did a torque stall as they rotated around the propeller and fell into the sea. What two pilots do that? Neither of them was killed, I'm glad to say. They both got out of their Sea Fury. Not the best thing to do.
So, how did you find your way back to the ship? Did you have a beacon to home on?
Yes, we did. We had the old YG beacon, which is a voice rotating beacon, and it wasn't the normal voice which you used in the UK, where you remembered exactly what was coming out at each of the segments. It was scrambled, so you had a little card which told you what it was going to be on any particular day.
So an enemy aircraft couldn't follow it in as well?
Yes, in theory they could, actually. In theory they couldn't. In practice they could have done it, because there are always ways of finding your way onto a beacon. but no enemy aircraft ever attempted to attack us.
How would you fly every day?
We would have 10 days on patrol and then 10 days back in Japan replenishing the ship, and our position would be taken over actually by a United States Marine carrier. So, and during the days on patrol, we would always fly, weather permitting, every day, usually two or three times a day. So we did quite a lot of sorties in that time.
Was it tiring? I mean, did you find you were getting rather exhausted, or was it a fairly easy flying routine?
I'd never felt tired, but I know that our senior medical officer was concerned, that he used to watch the aircrew quite closely, but when you're only in your 20s, you don't feel tired at anything, do you?
You weren't. I mean, did you meet a lot of ground fire or anything on your attacks, or did you have pretty much your own way?
Quite a lot, but most of it was very inaccurate. There were several targets, the prime targets, which did have good anti-aircraft opposition. We try and avoid those whenever possible. But the main bridges on the route going north-south, they had a lot of anti-aircraft, and it was not very pleasant to attack those.
Did you have any feeling about the Korean War itself? I mean, did you feel it was a waste of time, or that you were doing a necessary job, or what was the general feeling in the wardroom when you talked about it, or didn't you?
Yes, we did. We thought it was necessary, but I personally had quite strong doubts, not about the actual conduct of the war itself, but the work which we were doing, because our targets were mostly provided by intelligence, and that came from South Korean wolf packs, they were called. They used to infiltrate into North Korea and send back, by whatever means, information on targets. Now, these wolf packs were paid by results. And so, every time we attacked a target, perhaps months later, certainly weeks later, you'd get a feedback saying, when you hit that target, you killed so many North Korean troops, and it would always be successful every time. I was suspicious of this, partly because I didn't think this could possibly be the case, but also because you could imagine that these wolf packs would go along, get hold of the head man in a village and say, look, unless you give me whatever, you'll find that your village will be devastated. And if they didn't give it, sure enough, they'd call us in. And so I wondered about that.
You think you were being used to settle old scores, in other words?
Well, maybe. I have no evidence which says that, but I had this suspicion because of the fact that we were so incredibly successful, according to them. Lots of interesting little things happened out there. One thing I used to love was flying to and from the ship before we got ashore, before we got to the land. I would switch to the F-86 Sabre frequency and listen to the Sabre versus MiG battles up at the Yalu, which were fascinating because there was nothing like the kind of RT discipline that we used. you could hear what was going on as they were shouting about it. That was interesting. We had, at one time, the USS Missouri, the Mighty Mo, came up the west coast. Mostly the Americans were all on the east coast with their 6th Fleet, and we were on the west coast. They had one carrier and its screen. But the Missouri came up, and we did some spotting for it on targets. We were given the American procedure for RT for spotting, and we learnt this, went off and started talking to Mighty Mo and found that their procedure was different from the laid down American procedure. So we had to teach them over the radio their procedure before we could get any further. But it was quite interesting to watch those 16-inch bricks being thrown off from Missouri. Yeah.
And she's still around, too.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just one more thing about...
I'll just flop the tape over.
Oh, sorry, yes.
At the end.